You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For many runners, a marathon is the ultimate endurance test. Yet for so-called ultra runners like Scott Jurek, these 26.2 miles only account for the first quarter, sometimes even less, of a given race. Since he's won a number of the world's most difficult ultra runs and was profiled in the 2009 bestseller Born to Run, Mr. Jurek has become something of a rock star in the running community. He's recently released his own book, written with Steve Friedman, that is part memoir, part exercise instructional guide, and part vegan cookbook. It's called Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought Scott Jurek to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the marathon itself. Is the story that the traditional marathon is based on, the 26.2-mile run from Marathon to Athens that a Greek messenger completed after a battle, really true? Did it happen?
Believe it or not, there is no historical evidence. It's kind of been passed down as far as legend, but there is proof that Pheidippides, who was stated to run the marathon distance, actually ran from Athens to Sparta to get a message when the Persians were attacking Athens. So he was maybe more of an ultramarathoner than marathoner.
And then there's the sportathlon, a 152-mile race that stretches from Athens to Sparta. You've run that a number of times. That's also based on something from Greek mythology?
It is. And it's actually, there is historical record. Herodotus actually spoke about it in one of his historical accounts. So there is proof. And in fact, Pheidippides not only ran the 152 miles to Sparta, he actually turned around and brought message back to the Athenians that the Spartans, unfortunately, would not be joining them to fend off the Persians.
You began by running marathons, right?
That is correct.
How many had you run before you decided that they simply weren't challenging enough?
Well, believe it or not, 1 month later after running my first marathon, I ran my first 50-miler on a dare from a buddy. So I didn't really, explore the marathon distance a whole lot prior. So literally ran a marathon, and then a month later, I ran my first 50-miler.
But you didn't start thinking of yourself as a runner, did you? You were trying to prepare yourself for skiing?
That's correct. I used to hate running. I know a lot of people might find that ironic, but used to hate running as a kid, only did it later in high school to get in shape for cross-country skiing, which I fell in love with. And I just never enjoyed it, never found the enjoyment. And then a buddy of mine, Dusty Olson, showed me how running could be fun. And we just ran in the hills, ran and chased these trails out in the woods of Minnesota.
Do you think the fact that you both had troubled upbringings played a role in the fact that you became runners?
I think it definitely was a good outlet. You know, a lot of worse things you can do when you're 20 years old than run ultramarathons. And I think it's unique because a lot of 20-year-olds may not find it enjoyable to go out and run in the mountains or in the hills. But it definitely was a great way to, I guess, expend energy and kind of maybe work through life's problems.
Your dad kicked you out of the house. Your mother had MS. Dusty's dad was an alcoholic who left him and his 13 siblings. So because this gives you plenty of time when you're running to work things out in your head.
Definitely. And I think there's that bond, too, that occurs. I mean, runners are looked upon as a solitary lot. You know, that we're definitely,
talk to the people you're racing against, do you?
Well, you do a little bit. You only talk to them as much as you want. Maybe you try to get in their minds a little bit, play strategy.
Trash talk.
Yeah, exactly. And Dusty's really good at that. I mean, he's paced me in a lot of my 100-milers. I mean, we just, our relationship goes way back. And we just, learn how to, I guess, kind of discuss things that may not be discussed otherwise. I mean, running is a way to bring people together that wouldn't normally come together from all areas of life.
Yannis Kouros, who's often referred to as the running god, says that ultra races are ultimately about transcendence, and the only way to achieve that is by running further than training or genetics can prepare you for. Is that the way you see it?
It's definitely the way I've learned to see it. You know, initially it was just this challenge. It, you know, was out there. It seemed like a wild and crazy thing to do when I was younger. And now I've learned to appreciate the deeper aspects. And for sure, I mean, the actual definition of ultra is to go beyond. And go beyond, you know, the mind, go beyond even the body, and find out what else is out there. So it's definitely been a vehicle for me to explore myself.
who, of course, holds every ultra marathon record from 100 to 1,000 miles. Are there really races that last 1,000 miles?
There are, believe it or not. There's
one that
takes place. It's actually they usually get into loop courses. In fact, you know, there's a famous 6-day race. There's a lot of history behind 24 races. There used to be a race in Madison Square Garden, believe it or not, on the wood track. In Madison Square Garden back in the early 1900s. They're typically around loops, and I think that dates back to the early 1900s when people used to pulse it for 24 hours, square dance for 24 hours.
What would you prefer to run on? Is wood a good thing to run on?
I prefer dirt. I mean, when I get the choice, I do run on streets, and I believe that we can learn how to run efficiently on roads and less impact. But the best surface, of course, is running on dirt. I love to run in the mountains and chase a single track.
Because there's a little bit of give.
Definitely. There's give. There's also that change in the variation of the trail surface. So you're not doing the same repetitive motion over and over again. So trails are very good. Running is so repetitive. And as somebody who has treated a lot of runners from a physical therapy standpoint, it's good to get away from that repetition from time to time and work other muscles.
Well, how do you train for something like an ultra marathon? How many miles per week? And how do you simulate the extreme conditions that you run in sometimes?
The best way to prepare for ultramarathons is to obviously run, but it's surprising. Most people assume, oh, you must run, you know, 200 miles a week or more because you've got to do these crazy long runs. And really, the longest training run I do is 30, 40 miles. But what we do to prepare for the rigors of a 100-mile race, we try to do that back-to-back. So on Saturday, I'll go up for a 20, 30-miler and then follow up that on Sunday when, of course, my legs are sore and tired and do another 20 to 30 miles. So that simulates what it feels like at 70 miles into a 100-mile race.
And why do you do less? I understand most marathoners at most will run 80% of the distance. Is that to cut down on the chance of an injury or just not to use up all your strength?
I think it's a combination, probably physical. You know, you definitely want to prepare for that muscular fatigue and somewhat to prevent injury. But even more so, it's to practice eating and drinking and then to practice, you know, just mentally. What is my body going to feel like and how am I going to deal with that challenge on a psychological level so I can get through that in the race?
And would you do the 20 to 40 for any race? The Spartathlon is 152 miles.
Yeah, so the longest, believe it or not, you know, the longest I ran before I did my first 50-miler was around 25 to 27 miles. And for 100-milers, the longest is, you know, 30 to 40 miles. So, yeah, it's really about – it's more of a mental game more than anything. It's really about how can I get through these challenges, and if you're prepared for that. I mean, I've seen people run 30 miles a week and finish a 100-miler, so it can be done.
My guest is Scott Jurek, who's written with the help of Steve Friedman, Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. But you say that at times during these races, you may hallucinate and even fall asleep?
Yeah, I never used to think it was possible to fall asleep while running, but I did experience that in the Spartathlon. I was actually nodding off as I'm running up this mountain to finally descend down into Sparta. And you know, these races do take place in the late morning hours. Basically, I call the bewitching hour between 2 and 3 a.m. It's probably the sleepiest time as a runner I find. And I don't know if it was the monotony of the road that made me fall asleep.
But you didn't fall down.
I didn't fall down, no. I was literally running and still just nodding off.
Do you think the hallucinations are the result of sleep deprivation?
It's definitely a result of sleep deprivation. Dehydration can bring it about, extreme fatigue. And much like anybody who, I guess, has those similar physical situations brought upon them, hallucinations occur. And so there's definitely the medical evidence behind it. Is it a bad thing? I don't think so. But it's definitely an interesting part of the sport.
But the important thing is to keep on moving. You can't just stop for a moment and say, boy, I'm really tired.
Well, sometimes that happens. And obviously, if you want to win the race, you don't do much of that. But for me, I do occasionally, you know, stop to put ice in my hat or stop to go to the bathroom. I mean, you have to do those kind of bodily functions and take care of your body. But for the most part, I'm trying to stay moving.
Well, what's considered a good pace in a race that's 100 miles long? Obviously, you're not doing 4-minute miles.
No, definitely not. You know, in mountainous terrain, the fastest I've run for 100 miles is averaging 9:22 per mile pace, and that's, you know, with 18,000 feet of climbing, 23,000 feet of descent. And when I broke the American record for the 24-hour, which I had basically averaged 6.5 marathons at 4-hour marathon pace all in a row in 24 hours, and that's right around that 8:40 mile pace. So, you know, it may seem on paper like it's not that fast to somebody who's used to doing 5 or 10Ks and pushing really fast, but you start adding up that distance and those times over the course, and it's pretty challenging.
Well, if you run at that pace, you're definitely not going to win the New York City Marathon, but if the New York City Marathon then went on 4 more times, you probably would.
Exactly. I mean,
this is really about endurance as much as
it is, and it's more of a mental game. I'm not the fastest, nor am I the most gifted. I don't come from a family of gifted athletes. I have scoliosis. I had high blood pressure as a young child, teenager. I'm not a perfect specimen. I think a lot of people, and that's a real point to get across, because so many people say, I'm not built to run, I can't do this. And the beauty of the ultramarathon is that it's not all about physical ability. It's about the mind and going beyond the mind.
Well, you've called your book Eat and Run, but maybe it would have been better to call it Eat While Running. You seem to be doing it constantly during races.
Definitely. You have to be eating while you're running an ultramarathon, because...
Don't you get a stitch in your stomach? We were told not to eat and then go swimming.
Well, believe it or not, way back in the early 1900s, they used to think you shouldn't drink even water while you ran or performed endurance exercise. And so those both have been disproven, that you can actually digest food. Enough blood flow can go to the stomach to both empty water and food. So you definitely want to do it when running an ultramarathon.
You list all of the food you'd eaten by the 62nd mile in a race called the Western States 100, a bowl of thick rolled oats with banana, walnuts, soy yogurt sweetened with energy gel, many pieces of fruit, some bread, a bean burrito, more bananas, Clif bars, energy drinks. So how much do you have to consume in a race to maintain your energy?
Usually what I try to shoot for is in the neighborhood of 50 to 75 grams of carbohydrate, which comes out to, you know, in the neighborhood of 300 calories per hour. And as long as I'm doing that, I'm getting a steady stream. You never try to replace all the calories you're burning, because you're burning way more than that. It's just enough to get enough glucose to the
brain.
And
are you carrying that yourself?
I'm carrying basically enough that I need to get from aid station to aid station, which are about 5 to 8 miles apart, sometimes a little bit closer. So when there isn't an aid station that has the type of food I want, or it might just have water, I'll bring a little bit more. So I usually carry about 2 hours worth of food, 3 hours worth of food in these races.
You say that you studied the wisdom of an Australian named Percy Ceridi, who advocates following a Stoughton lifestyle. What's a Stoughton lifestyle?
Well, Percy was one, he was an eclectic coach. I mean, he was coaching another runner, Australian runner, who was basically competing against the great Roger Bannister, who, of course, broke the 4-minute mile. And his philosophy was that there was more to training than just logging miles. So it incorporated a diet, which was mainly a vegetarian, raw foods type of diet. He believed in vegetables and plant foods in their raw state. He did crazy things such as make his runners do drills up sand dunes, working on strength and balance. He was just known to be this eclectic coach, and it helped me in my kind of, I guess, desire to, how can I get faster as an ultramarathon? How can I get better? How can I better my body? And so I took a lot of inspiration from him.
Well, so not eating animal protein actually helps you as a runner?
You know, initially I wasn't expecting it to help me as a runner. I mean, I grew up eating meat and potatoes in Minnesota. I grew up hunting and fishing. I mean, I was definitely a Minnesota backwoods boy. And I decided at a relatively young age in my 20s, I needed to kind of change the course of my diet for long-term health reasons, seeing chronic disease in my family, seeing chronic disease in hospitals where I was trained as a physical therapist, and realizing there's more to health than just, you know, exercise and training.
Well, Ceridi also warns against drinking liquid of any kind while you're eating.
Well, again, he was at the time when sports medicine was still in its infancy and sports nutrition was in its infancy, and he was still trying to figure out things. But since then, and he was also preparing these athletes to run shorter distances, but I think he would advocate drinking a little water nowadays.
You can't dehydrate, especially when you're doing a race like the Badwater 135. Where you run from the lowest to the highest points in the contiguous United States and through Death Valley in July. Now, I've been to Death Valley
like fun,
in
huh?
June, and it's pretty hot by then. It must be scalding hot in July.
It's definitely scalding hot, and that's the idea. When the idea came about to put on this event, the idea was, let's do it during the hottest time, make the challenge even greater than it already was. And that's what ultramarathons typically, they put these events in the highest, the hottest.
Antarctica in another case.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado. And the idea is to bring out that extreme challenge.
Or it sounds to me like stimulate a certain amount of masochism in the person engaged. And what do you win for this? A belt buckle?
Yeah, if
no
those
money
listening,
involved?
If you're looking to become a rich ultramarathoner, I would definitely suggest another profession. But there's a lot more. And people do this sport because they love it, much like, you know, we see marathoners now. I mean, 20, 30 years ago, people thought, you know, runners were crazy. Why would anybody want to run a marathon? But people run ultramarathons for something greater than, you know, prize money or a prize. It's really about that accomplishment and what you learn along the way.
So many of them keep full-time jobs. Do you have to work additional jobs to support yourself?
Definitely, I have. And as of late, I've been able to become, quote, I guess, a professional athlete. It's funny, after, you know, 15 and now it's up to 18 years, the last few years I've been able to be more of a professional athlete. But I literally, you know, about ready to retire, and finally I'm able to make a living at it. So it took a long time. But
that's because of the Born to Run, the bestseller in 2009?
No, it's been due to sponsorships. I have, you know, shoe company Brooks Sports and Cliff Bar and others that have, you know, provided sponsorship funds. But, you know, I do a lot of speaking and I do a lot of events for them and getting out in the community and promoting the sport of running and, you know, just the benefits behind it too.
The third time that you won the Western States 100, you tore ligaments at the 44th mile. How were you able to run the remaining 55 miles?
Well, I definitely don't want to ruin anything for those that are going to be reading the book, but to put it in a nutshell, and I actually have a kind of a four-step process that I've naturally gone through. I haven't, like, designed this four-step process, but the idea was to show people that you can get through extreme physical challenges. And so how did I do that? I would say mentally provide an environment that I could get through the situation and think clearly, have the emotional I guess, feelings of this is, you know, my race is over, and eventually just get through that. And I think that's...
Even with a torn ligament?
Exactly. And, you know, as a physical therapist, I knew I wouldn't be doing greater damage. I mean, my ankle basically had swollen so much that it created this, you know, buffer and protection around it. So I knew I wouldn't be damaging more ligaments. But I'm going to say it definitely wasn't pain-free. I experienced a lot of pain. It was a hard last 50 miles.
Henry from Manhattan has written in. He wonders, how do you manage chafing? I just ran 50 miles this weekend and I got a bad shirt rash.
Well, nipple tape works well if it's a nipple type of issue, which happens quite frequently. But I highly recommend using some type of, I use unpetroleum jelly. There's various sports lubes out there that prevent that. So it's essentially the salt from the sweat creates this really frictionless environment that causes a lot of problems for runners.
You write a lot about proper stretching habits in the book. I would assume anybody who's serious about running would know about how to stretch.
Stretching is important. I actually, if runners are limited on time, promote strengthening over stretching. But because we spend a lot of time sitting, spend a lot of time in positions in front of computers or other modern technology now, the stretching helps get us out of those, you know, tight restraints. Hamstrings are tight, hip flexors are tight in runners, I think partly because we sit so much. So stretching is important, but, you know, maybe more important is getting out of those positions and, I guess, not allowing those muscles to tighten up over time.
You say that the best way to increase your speed is not by lengthening your stride, but rather by increasing the number of steps you take in a minute. So you take smaller steps?
Yeah, the way I like to describe it is think of it as you want to be in a granny gear. You know, you wouldn't want to climb an uphill on your highest gear on your bicycle. So in running, what you want to do is downshift into your granny gear and keep that spinning motion. So the higher the stride rate, the more you're spinning. And when you decrease the stride length, basically increase the stride rate, that'll allow you to spin more. So many people have these visions of, you know, they remember running from gym class or, you know, other sports where they had to really lengthen out that stride. And when you're trying to run for distance and trying to run for comfort as well as injury prevention, it's best to kind of keep that stride tight until you develop the ability to lengthen it out.
You ran and won a 100-mile race that took you 26 hours to finish, and that was a new course record, but also a number of hours longer than the 152-mile Spartathlon. So what makes the Hard Rock 100 such a time-consuming event?
Well, a little thing called mountains and high altitude, because there's over 33,000 feet of ascent on that race, 33,000 feet of descent. It is all performed in the, you know, high altitude country. It's like breathing through a cocktail straw when you're out there, because you pass over a 14er, six passes over 13.2. So, I mean, you're essentially, your average elevation is in the neighborhood of 10,500 feet the whole time.
Now, you said you're retiring, so that means you won't be running in this year's Badwater 135, which takes place this month?
Yeah, I've done it twice, and I'm not so sure it's the healthiest thing to do repetitively, but I am competing in the World 24-Hour Championships coming up in September over in Poland, so I'm excited about that event and have some new challenges down the road, but I have still a few more things I want to do.
But are you quitting ultimately because your body's aging, or just because you're getting bored with this?
I don't think I'm getting bored. I'm always going to run events. I think it's the competition at a high level. When doing it for so many years, I'm going to be quite honest. A lot of people assume that, oh, it's easy for Scott and all these top guys and gals. But mentally, it's hard to get out there and perform at a very high level. And I think it's more that, you know, self-induced pressure to compete all the time. And so I'm going to keep running, and I'll pop in races for fun. But it's definitely on a different level. I think it's finding that, and also maybe finding a new vehicle for exploration.
Well, you see, I would think that this would be very stress-inducing, and yet you seem to be a pretty happy guy. Is it because you're not running at this moment?
No, running has taught me to deal with stress in a way that is very efficient, much like going down to the Copper Canyon and running with the Tarahumara, and I learned a lot of lessons. That's in Mexico, just featured in Born to Run. And I much like I learned and read about other native peoples and, you know, the history of ultra running and running and learning from other extreme sports so that I could find out, you know, what is the secret to life? And I think it is being efficient and learning how to deal with stress and learning that we can get through difficult situations, both in life and on the running course.
What's the longest distance you've ever run?
I've run 165.7 miles in 24 hours. It's the longest.
Scott Jurek's book, Eat and Run. By the way, it has recipes. I should point that out. Right?
It does. I love to be in the kitchen cooking too. So when I'm not running, I like to spend time. It's part of what's interested me with the whole plant-based diet. There's so many amazing foods out there, both from the ethnic side to ways of making taste and textures come alive on the plant.
So now, so even after you retire, you'll maintain a vegan diet?
Definitely. And it's something I did, as I said, for long term. I wasn't expecting short term effects from this. It's really about long term.
The book is Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And my great thanks to Scott Jurek, who wrote his book with the help of Steve Friedman, for being on our show today.
It's been a pleasure.